This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is August 27th, 2020, and this is episode 204. And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we go back to school and we check in on Erin O'Toole. Thanks to the 100 people who contribute every month, I see things are stalling, dropping a little bit on our Patreon, and it's making me very sad. I'm on my last day of work before I go on an extended parental leave, so seeing more people join our Patreon at patreon.com/politicoast would make me feel very happy and help keep the show going long into the future. So patreon.com/politicoast. Support us if you like us. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. Let's kick it off with a segment on the back-to-school latest news. The big news of the week wasn't Rob Fleming's press conference, which ended up just really recounting what had already been decided, but the $2 billion that Justin Trudeau announced that the federal government was literally just handing to provinces, no strings attached almost.
Good. Schools could use all the support they can get as they try and reopen. A little more money's good on that front, but it's certainly cutting it a bit close. Schools are basically in the process of spinning up for the school year right about now, and why wait until the last minute?
Yeah, BC had already earmarked $45.6 million, as we talked about with Sonia a couple weeks ago, for things like heightened cleaning, physical barriers, technology changes, buying 1.5 million masks so every student, staff, and teacher can have two. So this government, this federal government money, which works out to $242 million for BC, and that's based on the number of students we have. So we work out to actually get less money than Alberta, who has more students, because Alberta is a very young province. It's welcome, but what can BC do in, it's now like a week and a half, 10 days until teachers are back in class, and 2 weeks until students are back in class? Like, it's not enough time to hire more teachers, which would help to do things like expand online classes, reduce class sizes in person, provided you could find classrooms to use, or even order PPE, because a large-scale additional PPE expansion takes time. Improving ventilation takes time.
Yeah.
It's late.
The thing about how this the federal government's handled things is, once they got over the initial flurry of immediate actions back in March, April, when the CERB got rolled out and a bunch of stuff just got rolled out in very quick succession, and they did a fairly reasonable job of that. But since then, they, I don't want to say slacking off, but the medium to medium long-term problems that were obviously going to arise, they needed action plans to get prepared as quickly as possible and to start making preparations for how to deal with that. They seem to have dropped the ball a bit or been slow to react on all of those.
And even the things they have been rolling out are pretty slow. Like, we've talked about sick leave promises a few times, and we talked about the changes from CERB to EI that were announced last week and the sick leave promises within there, but it, as far as I can tell, is still to be filled in a bit, and it will be COVID-only dependent, and it will come in via Service Canada and the EI system after Parliament resumes, which presumably means they need to pass legislation to make this happen. So that delays a lot more things. People are getting sick now, having to miss work now, having that backstop. 2 months ago, when we were talking about it, back in June, when John Horgan was talking about it, would be much better.
Yeah, and that's part of a broader issue, I think, is they we have a lot of economic problems as well, that the government's been hinting at the directions they want to take. We're more than 6 months into this and don't have anything more than the vaguest outline of a plan to deal with that. And overall, it just seems like the government has more or less, once the first wave of stuff got rolled out, just been sleep the switch, move back into slow prodding policy making rather than more of a crisis emergency approach to things, which isn't great because, well, we still have crisis and people are starting to get used to it, but that doesn't actually change the reality on the ground.
Yeah. And longer term, $240 million for the BC school system can make a significant difference. Like, it's a one-time cash injection, so it's hard to hire people longer term on that. But at very least, it helps the province's budget and can hopefully make October classes a bit more comfortable, even as September is still quite up in the air. But let's pivot and talk about what has been announced from Rob Fleming in the ministry earlier this week. I sat through his press conference and the questions, and like I said, it was largely an update on the plans that have been put in place. So yesterday was the deadline given by the ministry for every district in the province to have published their plan for back to school and school restart as laid out by the ministry. And that's basically what he was announcing, is that yes, every, you know, public school district, all the independent schools have put these online. So if you're a parent anywhere in BC, you can go to your school district's online website and see exactly what they're planning. It was something like 70% of high schools in the province are going to be switching to a quarterly system where there will be four semesters where you take two courses at a time. Like,
is it really a semester if there's four of them?
They're called quartermesters. Terms. What's even better is there's a handful where they're going to 8-term systems where you just take one course every day, all day for 5 weeks, and you just burn through it.
I feel like you're probably going to hit a point of diminishing returns around hour 7 of the class.
I think that's about the length of a school day, usually, if you think about it, with a couple breaks in there for lunch and snacks or whatever. The bigger issue is I think the pedagogy is pretty clear that we don't learn well like that, especially when it's, say, you take math 10 this September for 5 weeks, and then you don't see math again until second semester next year. You could have over a year between the time you've seen this subject. Students barely remember things after summer. So there's going to be a lot of interesting results coming out of the experiments we're playing with education right now. And it's not like we have better options, but this is a really tough situation. So a lot of districts are doing more creative things. Like here in Burnaby, the high schools were, like we talked about, allowed to have cohorts of up to 120, but they're actually aiming to keep their cohorts to 30 or 60, depending on whether you're in junior or senior high. And the way they're doing that is through that quarterly term system, and then also allowing some of the high school classes to be done hybrid, remote, online. So students are only spending half a day essentially in school, the older students. The younger students will be in full time, where they generally need a bit more supervision.
So obviously you want to minimize the amount of like person-to-person contact overall, but if you're spending 4 hours with the same 100 people, is that notice significantly safer than just spending 8 hours with the same 100 people? It really feels like once you're into the time units measured in hours, you're not really losing any safety the more you stretch that out.
So I think the goal with moving to taking fewer classes at once is that you're not at the upper end of those cohorts. What you're having instead is you only see one or two class, you only have up to two classes where 60 people interacting as opposed to 120. Or if you're only seeing one class and half the time you're at home, you may only see 30 people for a few hours at a time. And that does, I think, start to do some helping in terms of physical distancing. Now, this all still is based on the assumption that students won't break the rules and interact outside their cohorts, outside of schools, which
is good because teenagers are notorious for being sticklers to the rules.
And even with younger kids who obviously have similar challenges with following rules for more than like a few seconds at a time or a few minutes, you have daycares or family units where you might have kids in different classes who are then at home together, or daycares where they're like, we can't reasonably match the cohorts that are set up by the school districts. And so there's still going to be vectors through all of these different angles and through all these different students and family units that haven't quite been sorted out. Nevertheless, every district has been told by the ministry to contact every family in that district to determine what their fall enrollments plans are. Some districts like Vancouver have already completed this. Here in Burnaby, they'll have until September 1st to do it. It's dependent on when they got their plan on the website. Reports out of Edmonton say that nearly 30% of families have said they are going to try and keep their kids home and do remote learning of some type. I don't know if that will be as high in BC because we frankly just don't necessarily have as many options. Most of the public distributed learning, the remote learning options, are well oversubscribed or very full, and priority access is being given reasonably to those with the most complex learning needs. And there's also an additional challenge where students who switch to this remote or online learning aren't necessarily guaranteed your space back in a brick and mortar school. So the way it usually works is if you switch to distributed learning from in-class lessons, you then have to basically reapply if you want to go back to school. Now it makes sense that you won't be able to go online for September and come back in October because that just really messes with the district's ability to plan class sizes and hiring. But the uncertainty here makes a lot of parents very nervous.
Yeah, I can see how this may help allay some fears and uncertainty, but overall, it doesn't seem to be a huge step towards that compared to what we were talking about 2 weeks ago.
It's because not much has changed, really. All we know now is that districts have actually done better than the ministry was recommending, which I think is a very positive step in terms of these smaller cohort plans. That said, it would still be nice to know we had a path towards smaller class sizes, more online options, because those have not been guaranteed. Like, I've done a little bit of digging on this, and if you want to keep your kid home and teach them from home, you have the option of trying to get into a public distributed learning system. Now, the advantage there is you don't have to stick with your district. I live in Burnaby, but if I wanted to enroll a child in Arrow Lakes or whatever, Kelowna's online school, public online school, we could do that, provided they had space. But I think most of them are already fairly full and haven't hired enough teachers to expand it. Now there's the independent online system, and they've had some funding cuts recently, so there'll likely be tuition on there. And then there's the challenge where a lot of those are run by fundamentalist Christians because religious groups tend to keep their kids out of public or the fundamentalist religious groups tend to keep their kids out of public schools more often than anyone else. And so they've established those. And that might not necessarily be the right fit for many families, especially in diverse secular Vancouver. Maybe it will work for some. And then there are some secular options, but in the independent system, but I suspect they're also filling up pretty quickly too. And then you have just the traditional homeschooling option where you just agree that you will teach your kids, but then you're not guaranteed a diploma, as in you can't earn a diploma that way. And the parent then also has to be able to teach their child, which takes a lot of time and expertise, which is why we usually pay people to teach.
Yeah, so just seems like there's the minister is obviously doing the best they can, but there's still a lot of gaps here that don't really seem to have been filled. I don't really have any great ideas on how that can be patched, but it does seem we just had this deadline that we set that we're kind of come hell or high water going to have people back in school come the start of the normal school year. And even if everything wasn't figured out, we would just go for it. I can get why people want to do that, but it has certainly come with some problems.
Yeah, the BCTF is unsurprisingly reiterating its call for smaller class sizes, especially with the additional funds from the federal government and just overall slowing down the back-to-school plan. On the other hand, you have parents who can't just stay home and watch their kids for more weeks at a time. So they do need a back-to-school firm start date so that they can make sure that they're working and making money to feed said kids. It's not an easy situation. Would have been nice to see that money for schools come out even in June, but it's here now. We'll see where it goes. I don't think any of the provinces have really announced where they're going to spend their money.
Yeah, you don't necessarily have, you know, a plan in place if you were to suddenly get a 10% boost in your budget, which is roughly what this, I think, about 9 or 10%. Of the current education budgets, what's coming in right now, which is fairly sizable. And yeah, overall, it's just really one of those cases where we didn't seem to do as much long-term planning as we should have back in kind of your May-June timeframe.
We were all getting excited for the summer vacations we weren't allowed to have.
Yeah, but that does also mean political risk. So far, the BC government's gotten fairly high marks on how they've handled the situation, but the actual back to school time will be the real test of that. And you know, COVID cases are up, which adds another level of challenge around that. And well, the federal government has not been having a sort of political summer. And now that they've jumped in on this, they might now start to wear a bit of it too if it goes south.
Yeah, some of the initial pushback on the federal government's announcement was that it wasn't a very strings attached, but it was earmarked slightly towards air ventilation, sanitation, and PPE rather than whatever provinces want to spend it on. So maybe there'll have to be some further negotiations if provinces did want to spend it on salaries and shrinking class sizes. But yeah, back to school in 2 weeks. Teachers back in 10. We can move on.
Let's move on to our second segment, the right O'Toole for the job. So depending on what part of Canada you are living in, the new Conservative leader was announced either on Sunday or Monday of this past week due to a slight inability to open envelopes without shredding the ballots inside of them problem on the part of the due to a slight problem opening envelopes without shredding the contents of them problem the Conservative Party had with their leadership vote. But after 7 hours waiting or so, slightly after midnight in Ontario and a little earlier out here on the West Coast, results were finally announced. As expected, Derek Sloan got knocked off in round one. And final round, it came down to Aaron O'Toole versus Peter MacKay, where Aaron O'Toole won a fairly decisive victory, netting about 57% of the points available.
So it's always a good sign when your machines are shredding the ballots before they're counted. Like, I get that these aren't systems that are run very frequently, and COVID introduced another element of complexity to it, and this is an intensely stressful situation, so all sympathy with the political staffers in the back rooms there who were probably crying and having to tape ballots together so that they could make sure everyone was counted correctly. But really bad look there, compounded by the continual, oh, it'll be done in, we'll have it in 15 minutes. We'll have it in 20 minutes. And then, like you said, hours later, they announced the first round results. And then I think there was still another hour until they announced the second and third round, which had already been counted by then.
Yeah, it was a bit of a mess. There's basically no party that's ever announced their winner of the leadership race exactly on time. But this one definitely stretched it out a bit.
Delegate systems seem to actually work a bit more smoothly, mainly because everyone who's voting has to be in the room, but that wasn't going to happen time anyway. Delegate systems are problematic for other reasons. Let's dig in a little into these results, because while the final round was much more decisive than Scheer's like 50.01 to 49.99 type victory over Maxime Bernier, there were a lot of like little quirks in the raw votes in here. So in the first round, you had McKay come out on top, but with a weak 35%, I believe, to O'Toole's 30-ish, and then the other third split between Social Conservatives, Leslyn Lewis, and Derek Sloan. Leslyn Lewis, though, was at 43,000 votes to O'Toole's 51 and McKay's 53. Lewis actually won Saskatchewan and placed second in five races across the country, which was quite strong. O'Toole actually only managed to win Alberta and Quebec on the first round. And really Quebec was the only province he won in every round. McKay actually won the most provinces in the first round, but he just did not have those second choice ballots from anyone, which I think was what everyone expected.
Going into this, everyone more or less figured that McKay needed 45%, maybe if things went really well, 40% on the first round. Things weren't really well in subsequent rounds. He could skate by with 40% on the first round. Because the thing about being a front runner is people, if they're not voting for you, they've already considered you and are very consciously not voting for you if you're the front runner and not getting their first round vote. So they rarely pick up much in subsequent rounds. And we saw that last time where Andrew Scheer slowly crept up through the night as subsequent candidates were knocked off, and he got more and more of their votes. You saw then the BC leadership race that elected Andrew Wilkinson, where he finished second last in the first round and climbed his way up as the night went. Well, I think it was second last. He finished fairly far down in the first round anyway and crawled his way up.
I think the only person I've ever seen win each subsequent round till the end was Tom Mulcair in the 2012 NDP leadership race. And I think he had just enough ahead of Brian Topp in the first round that he wasn't so divisive that he was able to pick up steam to finally win it in the fourth ballot. But yeah, it is quite often on these ranked ballot systems that you'll see the second or third choice leapfrog at some point. So second round gets quite interesting as Leslyn Lewis wins the popular vote, which conservatives will remind you happened in the 2019 federal election, but they still didn't win government. So similarly, Leslyn Lewis got dropped off that ballot.
Yeah, turns out running up the points in Alberta doesn't necessarily help you win either the prime ministership or the Conservative Party race.
She actually won all four Western provinces, Alberta, BC, Manitoba, and Saskatchewan, in that second round. Like I said, Erin O'Toole only won Quebec in the second round. So luckily for O'Toole, at least, it's not just how many provinces did you win, it's how many points do you score. And Quebec had a lot of points.
Yeah. Although in O'Toole's case, he would have still held on to the final round because McKay actually came in third on the second ballot.
Yeah, it was very close between them in terms of points. It was 11,900 and some for O'Toole to, I think McKay was just under 11,800. Leslyn Lewis ended up with 10,000 in that round. So she didn't have enough to advance past McKay or O'Toole in some weird situation. I don't know what would have happened if it was Lewis versus O'Toole. I have to assume McKay's second choice voters would have gone to O'Toole.
Most likely, yes.
But people can be very weird. In the third round, though, O'Toole, like you said, takes it strongly. Mackay only really holds on to the maritime provinces where his support was pretty deep. I also meant to note in the first round, Mackay's only like moderately okay results were in Saskatchewan and Quebec, where he didn't place last. And I think he beat Mackay in Saskatchewan and Lewis in Quebec by only a handful of points. So he basically tied someone for last in those situations. Derek Sloan did not do well. At the same time, he also did pretty well because he didn't get below 10% of the vote or points in the end.
But only just barely cleared that.
Yeah. So maybe let's dig into that a little. What do these results actually mean for each of the contestants going from the first loser to the ultimate winner? Derek Sloan went into this not as a joke, but people strongly dismissed him. And yeah.
If you said the name Derek Sloan, people would have said who going into this. And outside of people who watch politics very closely, they'll probably still have the same result. But yeah, he went from that and then tried to run the...
People called it the 4chan candidate, I think.
The populist right 4chan type of thing. Like, came out strong against masks and mandatory vaccines and all that stuff, plus his social conservatism. And like, overall, I think just made a lot of conservatives pretty embarrassed about the whole thing. So I'm not sure he didn't... Like, he definitely raised his profile, but I'm not sure that was a net positive for him versus if he'd sat this race out and built up more experience, more connections and everything as he stayed in the House longer and longer.
So here's the question. What do you do if you're Erin O'Toole with Derek Sloan? Because I've seen calls for him to be ejected from caucus for his anti-choice and very social conservative views. And I've also seen the argument that he has a little bit of cachet because he helped make sure O'Toole won in the end. If those votes didn't go to Lewis and ultimately to O'Toole, this might be Peter Mackay's party today. Does he stay or does he go?
I think Lewis definitely gets much more credit for being the one to push Erin O'Toole over the edge. The difference between O'Toole's total votes in the first and third round is more or less just how many votes Lewis got, and you would have had drop-offs in both candidates and whatnot, but it's hard to make the case that had Derek Sloan's voters just not even showed up that it would have cost Erin O'Toole victory. So like, probably the thing to do is you give him... It makes the party look weak to be expelling people who ran in the leadership race and didn't do well. So I don't think it made sense to kick him out or anything, but you just don't promote him and keep him as a backbencher.
Wait for him to dig his own grave in this situation and then show him the door if he becomes a liability.
Yeah, exactly. You can give him...
In which case he can do as Carter suggested, I think, on The Strategist and go lead the People's Party. I think that's enough time on Derek Sloan,
that's
though.
Too much
Let's
time
talk
on Derek Sloan.
About that is true. Let's talk about Leslyn Lewis's quite a shocker performance for many people. I think we had the signs it was going in there, and I tried to emphasize that last week when pointing out how many donors she was getting and how much money she was fundraising. There was momentum there, and it carried through. It didn't carry her far enough, but making it to a strong second round showing is probably the like best she was going to do, given she had zero political profile.
Yeah,
8 months ago,
she did very well, and there was clearly some interest in kind of an outsider candidate who had a kind of very genuine persona about her, and I think she ended up connecting fairly well with a lot of conservatives on that. So there's definitely a strong future for her in the Conservative Party going forward. Short of winning, she probably came out of there as best as she could have possibly hoped for. And yeah, good result overall.
Yeah, there's an element of like conservatism in Alberta and Saskatchewan where I think they're conservative voters through and through. They're true blue to the core, but I think they actually just hate the Conservative Party. Like, they hate anyone who represents the kind of core, like, established Conservative Party, and they want maybe it to return to the reform roots, or maybe they just want to, like, vote for whoever the outsider is. I think it's part of why you saw Maxime Bernier do so well across the prairies, and why now Leslyn Lewis was sweeping some of the prairie votes in round two and doing pretty strongly in round one.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that there was no candidate on the ballot from definitely west of Kenora. I actually don't even know where Derek Swan's riding is. They were all from Ontario further eastward. So there was no person waving the banner for the Western Canadians. Everyone was vying for those votes. There wasn't an obvious spot for them to rally around.
But the other challenge I see with Lewis is, if you buy the claims that Derek Sloan's deep social conservative views, at least his anti-choice views, his homophobia, his transphobia views, are a liability to the Conservative Party and the future of the Conservative Party, I don't see how you can't apply that same lens to Leslyn Lewis, who is very upfront about she's not going to have a hidden agenda because she's not going to hide the fact she wants to roll back reproductive freedoms. So, like, how does the Conservative Party square that circle? Because they're clearly going to want to involve her more, given the strength she showed here. But at the same time, she's not, you know...
Fundamentally, the Conservative Party doesn't have a litmus test for their candidates on abortion. So that's not going to be the thing that's, if it does end up driving Derek Sloan out of the party, it's unlikely to be that unless he says something very offensive on top of just holding views on abortion that aren't necessarily those of the NDP or the Liberals.
But Lewis has called for specific bills to roll back reproductive freedoms in Canada, including trying to ban sex selective abortions and rolling back funding for maternal health programs around the world. She has also called for rolling back, and we went over this, trans rights in the Canada Human Rights Act. She is opposed to the conversion therapy ban. Like, she's not a candidate for the Conservative Party who would be marching in pride parades or be allowed to march in pride parades, frankly, for the views she holds. Like, this is a Conservative Party that just got out of a debate over whether they will still oppose same-sex marriage whether they will stop having no position on it and actually be fine with same-sex marriage. I don't think Leslyn Lewis is fine with same-sex marriage. Like, she hasn't necessarily said it explicitly, but drawing a pretty straight line from what's on her platform, she doesn't really seem like, she might talk a good game but about grassroots, but like, she's a hard social conservative.
But so's 20% of the country and a disproportionate amount of the conservative base, and well, maybe 15% of the country, but the coalitional politics aren't there to really just jettison everybody that the NDP would want to see gone. So like, it's just not going to happen, and I don't think there's really anything that's going to change that.
It's not just NDP voters though, it's people.
The leader's the one who gets all the attention, and backbench MPs or even shadow cabinet people just generally don't, and I don't think it's going to be a huge political liability going forward.
It depends whether O'Toole is able to play a better game than Scheer, who obviously was not a very strong leader, but you can definitely have your leadership subsumed or overshadowed.
I think he's probably going to be able to pull that off. His first couple press conferences, speeches, I think has already showed that he's well above Andrew Scheer in capabilities on those fronts.
Such a low bar.
That is true.
Well, moving from Leslyn Lewis, who's likely to have a bigger role in the Conservative Party, to Peter MacKay, where's his future? What company do you think he's going to announce that he's joining the board of? Because he's obviously not involved in the Conservative Party anymore.
Yeah, I mean, he made noises about running in the next election, because I don't think he could say you weren't going to do that if he lost, but I think it's fairly likely he doesn't run. Just like he's had a couple shots at this. It's not going to happen now. It's just not going to happen going forward. And yeah, I think he just leaves politics, goes back to the public sector, gets some, comfortable partner job with some law firm in Toronto.
He could always run for provincial politics. Maybe the Nova Scotia PCs are looking for a new leader at some point, and he tries there.
Yeah, perhaps.
I haven't actually kept up on Atlantic Canada politics for a while. I just remember a lot were in minority situations. A premier resigned recently, right?
Pardon?
I was going to say a premier resigned recently, I felt. Or New Brunswick's going to an election.
An election. You have Higgs versus, I want to say Blaine Higgs, versus Kevin Vickers, who made an interesting jump from Sergeant at Arms of the House of Commons to Ambassador to Ireland, I think, and then came back to run provincially.
That election's happening on September 14th. That's coming up very fast.
Yeah, coming up pretty quick.
You also have...
Yeah, it'll be the first provincial election under COVID, so it'll be an interesting one to watch just technically on how they managed to pull that off.
And they have the People's Alliance and Green Party both going into the election with 3 seats, so either of those could also increase or...
Be in a balance of power situation,
Have.
Yeah, anyway, circling back to Peter MacKay, what went wrong? Why didn't he connect? Or why didn't he have enough to put him over the line?
I don't think I think he flubbed so much so early with those. It was unclear why he was running. It was unclear what he was running for. He tried to pivot, I think, halfway through the race to pick up social conservative votes, but no one bought it because it didn't make any sense. And by that point, Erin O'Toole had already said, no, I'm going to be the guy who represents you. And he'd already essentially secured those second choice votes. It was just a matter of people figuring out who was their first. I think Peter MacKay just didn't have a strategy for this entire race.
Yeah, it was very unclear if he couldn't finish on the first ballot what his strategy was to win.
Like maybe he was hoping for another more moderate to enter the race so there would be a well to draw from, but...
Well, the thing is, like, Erin O'Toole is more or less that moderate. He, as we've said several times now, he's positioned himself more towards the center of gravity of the party because that was the smart thing to do in this campaign with the dynamics there. But would a third person, like if...
So if you had Michael Chong run...
Yeah, if you had like Michael Chong run or Lisa Raitt, like all you would have done would have been divided... The votes that O'Toole and MacKay got on the first round among 3 people, and that probably wouldn't have given MacKay any more of a decisive lead going into round 2 than he had on this one. So the only way it could have worked is if he'd been very strategic in where he put his resources in terms of trying to maximize the points for the fewest number of votes.
I think MacKay needed to connect with Quebec conservatives, but I suspect there weren't many, and those who were still in the party were tied with...
If there aren't many, that's actually a good thing to do, because...
No, but I think the ones who were in there were Scheer supporters. They were ones who signed on for Scheer and just haven't quite quit the party, or they are social conservatives because all the moderates in Quebec have moved over to the Liberals or just the Bloc again. So MacKay needed to sell more memberships. He needed to convince far more Canadians that he could bring a new voice to the party or even renew the party to the sort of PC days. And I think that brand of conservatism is largely dead. And I think MacKay got screwed because he couldn't do in-person events. And I don't know if he would have been that charismatic in person, but it doesn't help anyone to not be able to do in-person organizing when you're trying to win a leadership and sell votes or sell memberships. MacKay was stuck not being able to really get himself out there other than through the media, and the stuff he put out was bland and didn't have a vision.
Yeah.
If he could have tried to take a stronger, I'll be the conservative who will fight climate change from a conservative point of view, there might have been an angle there he could have pitched. Maybe he could have won some liberals or green supporters over. But he didn't.
Yeah, that I think was it. Like, no real strategic idea on how to do this. No real way to sell himself beyond, oh, I'm the best person to beat Justin Trudeau. And that wasn't very well done. And I think I said this last time, but there's very much like trying to fight the last war mentality with Peter McKay, where you're not going to win against Justin Trudeau by trying to out-charisma him. So just picking the, you know, bland but charismatic person to lead the party just wasn't the smart move anyway. And in that respect, they probably dodged a bullet.
Then let's talk about the ultimate victor, Erin O'Toole. I think we covered him somewhat last week. Where does he go from here? I think we both might have put money on him last week if we had to choose. I definitely was willing to give Lewis more credibility than many, but I didn't ultimately think she'd win.
Yeah, I believe on last podcast I said that I was pretty sure O'Toole would win. And I was fairly bullish on him from the start, mostly because all the people I know active in the Conservative Party volunteered on these campaigns all went for O'Toole, which is definitely a sign that there was more enthusiasm there than towards Peter McKay or the other two. But yeah, I think the Conservatives probably made the best choice of the four here on this. And for the five people who are still up watching the speech that he gave after winning, I think you can see why. And he's very much pitching the party not in kind of the Andrew Scheer mode of, we are just doing constant attack. The party has one mode, which is attack Justin Trudeau while playing to the base. And instead, both his first speech and the press conference he held on Tuesday took much more of a, we want as many people in the big blue tent as possible. We're positioning ourselves as a place where a lot of people can go home who aren't happy with the current government. We're going to be the responsible, serious-headed people who, you know, want to run the government and get the country through the current situation and its current troubles, which is probably the right position to take as the Conservative Party. Because, like I said, you're not going to just out Justin Trudeau, but his big weakness is that he's not necessarily seen as the most serious person and who has a tendency to put style over substance in a lot of ways. And in that respect, I think Erin O'Toole contrasts fairly well against him and is going to be able to make the case to Canadians that, okay, sure, the feel good about Canada sort of thing was fine for 2015. This is serious times, and serious times call for serious leadership.
I think all that's fairly accurate, and I didn't manage to catch the speech, but I caught some of the pull quotes from it, and that was the tone that I read from there. And I think you're right that I couldn't disagree that O'Toole out of these four is probably the one who's, I probably ultimately, I don't know if I'd have picked him, but I think he's probably the strongest leader for the party, and I think he's the one most likely to do the most with the Conservative Party. There were a couple points in the poll quotes that I cringed at the language choices, the Take Back Canada framing. No matter who uses it, I don't think it's great, and it got called out a lot. Referring to Indigenous Canadians is just not, I won't say politically correct, it's just not the most sensitive or accurate way, but those are, you know,
I'm not sure anyone
nitpicks versus
spend a lot of time really engaging with those sorts of issues is even going to notice that. So, yourself to Canada, it's hard to even call that a misstep in terms of the politics of it.
Although I do think, as a leader of one of the parties likely to form government, taking action towards reconciliation, whatever that format looks like, it doesn't have to look at like the Justin Trudeau format, because that's all talk and no substance. You can be the Prime Minister of Reconciliation without taking the Justin Trudeau approach. Those two things aside, O'Toole's biggest challenge right now is name recognition. You joked about no one being able to name Sloan or Lewis before, but honestly, a lot of Canadians don't even know who Aaron O'Toole is. That will obviously change. I don't think many people knew who Harper was when he was first named leader. And O'Toole, I see, is taking a very similar tact in terms of that. Like you said, he's the serious guy in the room kind of mentality or that approach. I think we still need to see a climate plan from Aaron O'Toole that isn't just, we may as well stick with oil for a while because, and maybe natural gas, because we better get our money out of the ground.
Yeah, there's a couple things about nuclear in his platform that I think were pretty promising.
But that's not a climate plan.
It comes paired with some fairly serious action on it, and not just as a thing to just be a shield against attacks on the climate front.
Yeah, we need a lot done on climate, and because every year that we have a government that doesn't act or doesn't act thoroughly enough or promises to undo the actions of the previous government is like, clock is ticking, people. Someone better do something.
Yeah, so that's a challenge for him. And I think the other, we have the ever-present challenge that every conservative leader has of holding the coalition together. And that front, he's probably going to be better than McKay, but I can't really say how well he's going to do on that or whether or not that's going to be too much of a distraction and weaken their or take away their focus from what they should be doing. And the other big challenge, I think, is finding a way to navigate the current situation that make that kind of both matches the conservative principles and temperament, not seeming out of touch with the challenges everyone's facing. And that's definitely doable, very much a kind of wartime crisis sort of mentality to it and general disposition could work fairly well there, but there will definitely be factions of the party that's trying to pull him, or that would definitely be trying to pull him back from supporting the larger programs that are going on in response to this, or trying to, or would be opposing a O'Toole pitched equivalent of those. So I think that's probably going to be his biggest challenge. I think he's probably smart enough to see those challenges and try and address them, but how successful that's going to be is a big question.
Of course, if I'm the Liberals, I'm leaning into the always attack conservatives with the scary hidden agenda. The maybe O'Toole himself doesn't have the hidden agenda, but you can point to social conservatives in his caucus who even did well in this leadership race and say, this is the party that's running these people, and whether or not Aaron O'Toole can keep them in check is...
The inevitable bozo eruption.
Yeah, that brings down so many conservative parties.
So yeah, overall, I think this is probably a good development for Canadian politics in general, just because it's, regardless of what you think of the Conservative Party in general, it's just good to have a system where you have multiple parties that can realistically win elections and contest power, and you don't get the complacency that comes from long governments that feel secure to run any election they want, don't really concern themselves too much with the public sentiment. So in that respect, I think O'Toole brings the Conservatives into a much more competitive position for the next election. And in general, that's a good thing for the country, that there's will likely be a much more competitive election next time.
Honestly, anyone was likely to make the Conservatives more competitive than Andrew Scheer.
No, like, Derek Sloan would have managed to make the Conservatives somehow less competitive than Andrew Scheer, which hard to think possible, but nevertheless would have happened.
Fair enough. Let's move on to quick takes. First up, let's do a little bit of roundup of COVID-19 news. We've talked a little bit about COVID off the top. Case numbers have been worryingly high in BC for the last couple of weeks. We were passing 100 cases a day for a while, and we surpassed the highest number of active cases we had even back in April or May. But luckily, in the last couple of days, it seems like we've hit a plateau. Nevertheless, the government has rolled out a couple new announcements, the most major one of which was there are now $2,000 fines for anyone who is caught organizing a party of or event of that's in contravention of the rules. So whether that's over 50 people or more than five people in a vacation rental, and already some guy in Victoria has been fined $2,300 under this and related fines. And he acted very dumb about it, talking about how he made sure people were leaving as soon as he heard the cops were coming. I want to feel sorry for him in a way, but then he kept quoting himself about how he would effectively perjure himself. He was, yeah, I'll just go before the court and say there were 15 people there. It's like, dude.
What a dumbass.
Don't say that in the media. Like, I get that the rules are sometimes hard to keep up with. Things change quickly. And so there is like some willingness that I have to grant people ignorance about what's happening, but sometimes you speak and you remove all doubt. Next up, more and more places are starting to require masks. This week, I think, was the first week that TransLink and BC Transit were requiring masks. BC Ferries has started requiring masks, and all Loblaws, so all Superstore and your independent grocer and those kind of companies are going to be requiring masks as of Saturday. So make sure you stock up on your cloth masks.
Good, but like, why is it taking so long to do this? So after the initial back and forth on whether or not masks were helpful or harmful, which we more or less had resolved by the end of April, actually earlier than that, I think, I don't know, times are a weird thing this year. Why wait months to bring this into effect? And same thing with the fines for large groups. Just, it's a crisis. Go hard, go fast. Like, it's going to be hard to overcorrect too much in the opposite direction for simple things like not having large groups of people together or wearing a mask in public transportation systems.
I can see the fines not being necessary as early because we were fairly effective, especially in the first round, at just obeying the rules because it was the right thing to do. But I think as there's been more and more talk of reopening and restarting and all of this, people are just getting softer. And so if you're not going to ramp up the rhetoric again and acknowledge that cases are rising, then I guess you have to bring in fines if you're not doing the carrot again.
Yeah, but like on the face mask thing, TransLink waited, I think, 3 weeks between when they announced and when they brought it into place. And like, they could print up signs and blast out that stuff over a couple of days and that make it a lot quicker. There's just a lot of things.
I suspect part of it for TransLink was giving people time to get their exemption cards if they were one of the small number of people who had a valid reason for not wearing a mask.
Perhaps, but like, still 3 weeks seems excessive in a crisis.
Agreed. One of the things we're...
And 3 weeks seems excessive, and 4 months to even start that is very excessive.
One of the other things we're not moving very fast on is the province is not moving very fast on collecting data on how COVID is affecting racialized people, ethnic groups, and people with disabilities and minority communities. Shannon Waters has a piece that's publicly available in BC Today that we'll link to, where she tracks the story of how the province has committed to collecting this data, but has stalled as they wait for the feds to do something. So we don't know, even though other jurisdictions who have this data have shown that there is a pretty strong correlation between your social status and your identity and how COVID-19 is affecting you. So would be nice to have this data, but we don't.
And yeah, definitely would be good to have that. And something else that would be good to have, and we should try and minimize the delays on, is vaccines, which it was reported today in, I think, both CBC and Global, that apparently we had a partnership program that to test a developed in China vaccine candidate that didn't end up happening because that China back in June had refused to issue the export permits for it out of China, which not great. And the suspicion by the people quoted in the article, although it hasn't really been confirmed, is that this is another outcome of the various tensions that have persisted between Canada and China for several years now.
Yeah, the geopolitics of vaccine development are getting increasingly worrying. You have Trump, I think he's mused at some points about not sharing patents or making open source vaccines, and just willing to literally profiteer if America can off the suffering of people around the world. Russia is like skipping steps to try to claim to be the first who develops a vaccine just for its own ego. And this element of the story, which is, you know, also frustrating, there's a really good public interest argument in terms of taking the development of vaccines out of any private, like it needs to be the world needs to develop these, not any individual company or country or anyone who's likely to put it in their own self-interest first. Ideally, I'm just being an idealistic.
There's something to be said for basically anyone with vaccine expertise throwing themselves at the problem, and that the costs of not having a vaccine every day are huge. Billions of dollars globally, huge, for just delaying getting a vaccine by a couple of days. And yeah, in theory, it would be great if, you know, the WHO or some international body just whipped one up real quick. But absent that, just getting as many people on board with it as possible. And if some company manages to be the first one there, and because of that, globally, we don't lose hundreds of billions of dollars to trillions of dollars, then making a little money in compensation isn't necessarily the worst thing either.
I'm fine. Like, we can pay out these companies, but it's also like a race to a lottery winner. Let's pay all companies that are working diligently and reasonably well at this equitably. But the reality is, like, most vaccines won't work. And so let's at least, it's winning the lottery. It's not actually that one company is better at developing a vaccine. They are just ultimately going to get lucky. So it's not a great capitalist argument in my mind, but I agree. Let's get as many people working on this. We need systems and check around the world to prevent profiteering, whether that's economic by a private company or by a nation, or geopolitical profiteering, as seems to be the case here. I don't know how we get there, but that's the utopia I want to live in. Moving into the other utopia I want to live in, it would be great if people weren't dying from overdoses at record rates in British Columbia. But sadly, we have the numbers for July, and another 175 people have died, bringing us to 909 for 2020. Which isn't great. And it's gotten to the point where four drug user advocates who were part of a overdose crisis response committee for the province have quit. This includes Garth Mullins, Dean Wilson, Leslie McBain, who co-founded Mom Stop the Harm, and BC Yukon Association of Drug War Survivors President Hawkfeather Peterson. They've all just been frustrated with the province's lack of action, in their view, on this, and inability to really tackle this effectively, which is not a great look for the province to lose people who are on the front lines of many of these fights. In the province's defense, there have been some efforts at opening up safe supply in BC, especially during the crisis. It's been pretty clear that those have been insufficient. The chief coroner and public health officer have been quoted multiple times in repeated press releases each month saying more needs to be done. And it's just not clear how much is being done or how quickly. So hopefully we see some changes start to happen soon. Like, big changes because there has been like little bits of money rollout, but not enough.
Something that is a bit of a change is when former leaders of provincial parties decide to insert themselves into the leadership race to replace them. In this case, Andrew Weaver, the outgoing, now technically an independent, but very much the former permanent leader of the Green Party, is now on the advisory council of leadership candidate Cam Brewer, which is weird because generally former leaders don't involve themselves with these sorts of things, so as not to seem to be biasing the direction of the party that takes after them.
Yeah, this isn't an official endorsement as far as I can tell, but it's still
weird. If Stephen Harper had joined the Leslyn Lewis team as an advisor, like that would have raised people's eyebrows, as this kind of does.
I'm just scrolling through Weaver's Twitter trying to see if there's any sign on this. He has his tweets from early August where he's attacking the Greens for taking out ads for whatever reason, trying to get star candidates. But then on the 17th, he says, wow, just saw this, that Cam Brewer picked up, in his words, the single most experienced Green campaigner in Canada to lead his leadership quest. And that's when Jonathan Dickey from the Green Party of Canada's former national campaign manager joined it. So there's some at least sympathy and willingness to bump up Cam Brewer's campaign. And Weaver has been quite critical of Sonia Furstenow and particularly her position on four-day work weeks.
Yeah, he definitely doesn't seem to view the norm of the role of an ex-party leader as something to take particularly seriously. So it wouldn't surprise me if we see more of this norm breaking as the voting nears.
In the meantime, Cam Brewer will be emailing you soon to ask you to come on the podcast and talk not much about Andrew Weaver, but more about what you want to do as leader, because we've already talked to Sonia Furstenow and Kim Darwin, and I encourage everyone to go back and listen to those episodes. But to close off today, let's turn our attention back to federal politics, where the We Charity scandal continues to be in the news. The government released a tranche of documents recently with many redactions, and it turns out those redactions didn't follow the normal procedures.
Yeah, so the House of Commons, Parliament, they're more or less supreme, have a huge amount of privilege in what they can and can't see, and they basically get to see almost everything. There's a couple exceptions, national security and cabinet confidence. But those decisions don't get to be made by the government necessarily. Everything's supposed to go to the House of Commons law clerk, and the law clerk does the redactions before giving the documents to the parliamentarians, which didn't actually happen here. The government departments took it upon themselves to decide what parliament gets to see and what it doesn't, which is a very big no.
I remember seeing the pictures of Peter Polyev flashing around the heavily redacted documents, doing his typical flair for the dramatic. Sometimes he has a point, and like he's been accurate on this, that the government is going too far. Hopefully we get to hear more. I think we've learned some interesting things out of those documents, but unfortunately committees are not meeting anyway.
Yeah, so Peter Julian at the NDP, once he found out about this, asked the law clerk to demand that the documents that Parliament is entitled to actually get produced. But the response to that was, well, they can't actually do anything until their committees are back in session and prorogation ends.
I guess we'll do a follow-up on We after September 23rd then.
We still have a minority parliament, and I can't imagine the committees are going to let this one go.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Polite Coast is a production of Lightning Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.